ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Rick Lane. Rick most recently was SVP of Government Affairs at 21st Century Fox and News Corporation for over 15 years. He was responsible for coordinating the development and implementation of the company's public policy activities. He's also an expert on the future of work, which explores the disruption to our economy as a result of the fourth industrial revolution, which encompasses a range of new technologies that are fusing the physical, digital, and biological worlds and impacting all disciplines, economies, and industries, and for which everyone should be prepared. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me today.
That's a really interesting topic. And so, first off, you spent over 15 years as the SVP of Government Affairs at Fox. And before we dive into, you know, the fourth industrial revolution and what does this mean for employment, let's back up and understand a bit of your background and how you got into this field, really. So, can you tell us a little bit about that role and how your career has progressed to get you there?
Sure, happy to. So, I was responsible for coordinating the development and implementation of 21st Century Fox's public policy activities with a focus on digital distribution of our content. So when I started at Fox in 2001, we really didn't distribute our content online, not at all. And so I was responsible for helping develop the rules of the road, so to speak, for how we would protect our content, what were the privacy issues surrounding it, cybersecurity, et cetera.
Okay. And so would piracy fall under that as well?
Oh, absolutely. I that was probably the main focus of my 15 years was how to create a safe, secure, and sustainable internet, especially around the digital distribution of content. And piracy is having obviously a major impact on our digital distribution. It is the biggest competitor to a company like Netflix.
Right.
And so it's a huge issue for the company and a huge issue for the country as a whole.
Yeah, it's interesting. We did a survey of young millennials and their attitudes and behaviors around ad blocking and piracy, and we actually found a synergistic relationship between the two. It's very interesting that their attitudes around it, they know what they're doing. They feel like downloading is wrong and they do less of that than the streaming, but they absolutely do it and they don't feel it's wrong. And, you know, sharing passwords, all of this. And it was interesting last week talking to Himu about the bad actors who are involved now in linking into these sites and creating sort of perhaps some incentive for people. I mean, it's a horrible thing, but perhaps some incentive to stop the piracy other than the moral imperative and the larger business imperative, which maybe they don't really feel personally attached to.
Well, I always found it interesting talking to millennials and young people at colleges and high schools about piracy. And I would ask them, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, what's your job, your ideal job? And so many of them would say, I want to develop the next great app, the next Facebook, or the next, you know, you pick it that's out there. And I would say, so imagine after you graduate, you spend all this money developing that great next app. And the next thing you know, it's on, you know, an Android app site, a perfect copy of your app that you spent all your money, all those years developing, and, you know, someone's making money off of it. How would that make you feel? Well, that's wrong. But you think it's okay to do that to somebody's movie or music. What is the difference? And they don't have an answer for that.
No, it's really interesting. In fact, after we put out a report, wow, we got trolled quite a bit, actually, for our inability to understand, you know, how copyright really ought to work. And I just thought, well, these are people who just haven't created any intellectual property of their own.
Right. And it is the future, it is the future of this country economically. And it's the cornerstone of how we're going to engage in the future and be competitive as a country.
Right, right. And so we need to sort of these rules of the road. How do you think that blockchain feeds into that? I mean, obviously, the disintermediation has other knock-on effects, which we can touch on later, but simply in terms of a piracy effect.
Well, I think it's still hard to say. I mean, the one thing about blockchain and using some type of shared ledger system to know who owns what, there's definitely a lot of interest in Hollywood on that topic. And can it help be helpful in piracy, especially when some claim, well, if we knew who owned that movie or that book or that song, you would have paid them argument. And I think that's always been...
how sincere.
Yeah, you know, it was too hard to find it, you know, that the owner, the author, the copyright owner. So if that can help with that, that will be absolutely great. But it's still, you know, always hard in the digital environment to completely stop piracy. And that's, I think, one of the things that people don't understand when we engage in discussion of stopping pirates is they will say, oh, it's a whack-a-mole problem. You know, we had this debate on the SOPA PIPA side of things. It's a whack-a-mole. You can't stop these people from, you know, breaking the law. Well, I would argue that crime is a whack-a-mole problem.
Yeah, general, fair, right?
That's why we have police, you know, and we don't know which bank is going to be robbed. So crime in general is a whack-a-mole problem. But you don't throw your hands up and say, you know what, we can't catch all the criminals, you know, 100%.
So let's give up, yeah.
So let's give up. And so I always found that argument interesting. But you do have to also at the same time provide individuals with the ability to get the content when they want it, how they want it, when they want it. And I think, you know, we saw what happened to the music industry from a movie, you know, movie industry perspective. And I think if you look at what's out there, the availability of content is unbelievable. There's so much legitimate digital distribution now doing 4K through Netflix or Hulu. We go down the list, all the streaming apps now with the cable companies, you know, there are a tremendous amount of legitimate access points to get content. And so the argument is, oh, I just can't get it anymore. It is just not legitimate.
Right, right. But yeah, and what's the experience? I think the challenge is people want to have all of it in one place. And I think that's ultimately, and a number of people have said this, you know, the discoverability is a challenge. How many services is somebody going to sign up for? And ease of use, frictionless use. And so in some ways, it's how are the giant players going to come together to create something that will protect them all by existing in a way that consumers want.
Well, they did that. It's funny. Someone said, well, why don't all the studios get together and create one website so we can get everything? I said, well, the only problem with that would be the Justice Department and the antitrust laws.
Yeah.
You know, we can't do that. We can't all get together and say, hey, we're going to set our price and have, here's where we're going to gain access to it. But I do think there would be some, probably Netflix would be the first one to say, you guys can't do that, but in others. And so you can't do that. You have to have different distributions. You can't, you know, one of the big antitrust cases when the studios had to give up owning the theaters because they had sort of a vertical monopoly. And so we can't do that.
Well, that's interesting though, because you look at, you know, Comcast and NBC, right? That's the pipe and the content. And the growing consolidation in the industry. So it's a monosopoly? I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's not a monopoly, but it's right. It's getting there. And then what do we get when we think of, you know, Google or Facebook/Instagram, right? I mean,
right.
Massive companies. And at what point do they run afoul of antitrust? Nobody is a competitor to them.
Well, you know, it's fascinating because if you look at this whole debate about AT&T buying Warner Brothers, the combined company of AT&T and Time Warner is still 50% the size and market cap of Google or
right.
Apple
right.
or Amazon. So it's interesting. They say, oh, this is a mega merger. Yet in order for them to compete with Google distribution, and now Google's starting to invest into their own movies and television shows, so is Apple, so is Amazon, and you have, the cost of creating content is going through the roof because of the competition for great scripts and actors and talent and the workers who build the sets and all that, which has been great for that side of things. It's made it much more expensive. So these companies do have to combine, but you also have to look at it. It's the impact it's going to have on our ability to distribute content internationally. You know, most of the market right now for the industry is overseas. So 70% of revenue is coming from overseas, not from the United States. The U.S. is basically a saturated market at this point.
Right. Very true. Well, I've certainly got us a little off base here. Now let's drag it back. It's very interesting, but I'm going to pull us back just a little bit.
And we can do another topic on, you know, later on,
I know, right?
The future of the movie
really
industry.
Interesting.
Happy to do that. And piracy.
Yeah, that actually is a definite thing. I find piracy fascinating in the motivators, but trying to pull myself away. So while you're in this role looking at policy, you also worked at the United States Chamber of Commerce. Now, so yes. Did that experience inform what you were doing in terms of, I mean, what you were doing for Fox?
Oh, absolutely. It's sort of what led me to Fox. You know, working at the Chamber as the Director of E-commerce and Internet Technologies back, you know, starting in 1999, all these digital policy issues were cutting edge. Privacy, cybersecurity. You mentioned blockchain. The foundation of blockchain is the digital signatures legislation that I was heavily involved in and the point person for the business community on the e-sign legislation that led to the foundation of blockchain. But even the e-sign bill, the digital signatures legislation, was controversial. We almost did not get that through because we had to fight a lot of consumer groups who were very concerned about people being able to negotiate contracts in a digital environment. And really, we had a huge, you can talk to Andy Pincus about this, you know, a lot of conversations with the Clinton administration to make sure that that got through. And there was a lot of nervousness back then. But the issues are still the same today as they were back then. And there's always concern about what technology, the impact technology will have on current businesses and jobs. And working at the U.S. Chamber really allowed me to use, you know, be part of the largest business organization in the world to affect change at the beginning of this digital revolution, and then migrating to 21st Century Fox or News Corp at the time to help with their discussions on privacy, cybersecurity, and digital distribution was just a natural and an incredible opportunity to work for a fabulous company.
Right, of course. And well, you have a legal background. You worked for one of the largest law firms here in New York, right?
Well, I actually worked in the Washington office, but I'm not a lawyer. Most people sometimes accuse me of being a lawyer, but I say, no, I am not. I'm a technologist. My focus has always been on the technology side. Now, have I helped draft copyright legislation? Absolutely. And other pieces of legislation? Yes. I used to say when I worked at the law firm that I have, you know, I can help draft the legislation. I can help get it passed. But once it becomes law, I can't talk about it anymore. But then someone wants to change it, give me a call.
Right. Well, at least they have somebody who actually understands what they're talking about. I think that's so important. Do you foresee technology development accelerating? Is this what we're, you know, when we think about all the ways in which tech is starting to change, is it not only that it's changing, but the change is accelerating? Is that a fair?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, if you just think about what has happened in the past 5 years with artificial intelligence and the growth of technology, Siri, all the different types of, you know, Alexa, the Echo, things like that. You know, we're finally integrating technology more so than we've ever seen in our daily lives, you know, from the thermostats in your house, you know, to your, obviously your smartphone, to your car. I mean, the acceleration of technology into our daily lives. We just have never seen this before. So there's a lot of unknowns that we have to start figuring out.
Well, right, because it's not just the technology itself, but it's also the fusing of different types of technology across what typically in the past haven't been connected, right? When we're thinking about the Internet of Things and also how biology and just all of the aspects integrating more, right? So it's not just we're having technological development that's going very, very fast, but it's going very, very fast and integrating with itself, yes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about the so-called network effect, it's real. And companies that can control the network effect will dominate. And the part that is unknown, the parts that scare people like Elon Musk, you know, where he says, you know, AI is a fundamental, you know, risk to human civilization.
Right.
I think what he's seeing and what others are seeing is that you have AI communicating with itself. And humans don't know what they're doing and then they're communicating. I had a conversation with somebody who has an AI company, and I was telling him that I'm working on the future work and the impact of AI and automation. And he said, let me just tell you a story. He said, you know, we set up a program, an AI program, to communicate working on one subject matter. And then we started getting reports on something completely different that we had never asked for. And he said, it freaked me out. And so, and he works for, you know, an entity that works, you know, the highest levels of,
yes, right.
It's the uncertainty, and we don't have rules for the road at this point. And
that's that's actually one of the things that I did want to ask you. In these conversations I have with people on the podcast, one of the things I often do is ask their opinion about various things. And one of those things is AI. And it's really interesting because the range of reactions goes from, it's already here and it's fantastic, to genocide bingo, we're all going to die, it's a really bad idea.
Right.
I have to say, as I told you offline before we really jumped into the interview, I tend to land myself in the genocide bingo camp because I am, you know, I watch Terminator, I don't, you know, and the speed and, you know, the business of developing your own language, and then I don't know what they're doing, and then how do I control it, and then should I control it, and what's the ethical ramifications, and it just gets so fast, so big, that I think, well, how could you wall it off so it wouldn't be dangerous? But then I think, or am I being crazy? So where do you fall on the spectrum?
Well, I don't fear it. I think we need to embrace it. I think some of the positive outcomes of AI on health and other parts of our lives it's just going to be amazing, and it's going to be incredibly beneficial. But we can't do it the same way people look at the internet. You know, one of the things about the internet, it's, you know, they say, oh, it's different. You know, laws shouldn't apply. It's borderless. You know, everyone, you know, government shouldn't be involved. You know, all these different, you know, utopian visions of what the internet is going to be like or should be, I think is unrealistic and naive. And I think going into looking at AI, it's not that we need to heavily regulate it, but we do need to better understand it. You know, for example, you know, AI will be used to figure out what jobs people should get. You know, you put in your resume, right?
Very brave new world to me.
And then it figures out, you know, but it could be a good thing, right? So somebody who's unemployed in Montana puts their resume in and they say, hey, here's a great fit for you in Nebraska if you're willing to move, right? So it can be a great thing for somebody who's unemployed. But, you know, are there issues of discrimination that, you know, who's programming that AI? What are they looking at? So there are issues that transcend technology that are just fundamental laws and regulations that we face in the everyday workplace. And we just have to make sure that they're being adhered to in a way that makes sense without stifling innovation, because you don't want to do that because so many great things can come out of it.
Well, I guess here's another question really in thinking about how is the workplace going to be transformed. If you have AI, which is, for instance, you had mentioned medical diagnoses, you have some AI is already able to find melanomas better than doctors, just better at it. Now, a doctor is a highly skilled job. I mean, we're used to automation taking out, you know, oh, it's, you know, the gas station attendant. But taking out a doctor or a lawyer who drafts contracts, or, you know, not all, like obviously probably litigation, it wouldn't work. But then if we, you know, I mean, there are some what we consider pretty high skill jobs, which everybody's like, my boy's going to be a doctor and he'll be great. Or my girl's going to be a lawyer and she'll, you know, take care of me in my old age. And now all of a sudden, that's not, you know, those people are going to be displaced, or a certain number of them are going to be displaced.
Well, I agree. I, you know, most people today see automation AI as only impacting low-skilled jobs, the person who flips hamburgers for a living. But the reality is that the impact will be far broader and deeper.
Right.
We truly, you know, do not know what automation AI, how it will take hold and the impact it will have on not just low-skilled jobs, but, as you said, lawyers, doctors, financial institutions, and other white-collar jobs. One of the things that we need to make sure is that we're looking at the solutions. I mean, this is a far broader and deeper transformation. And again, it's not about one of the arguments that people get into is, will this create more jobs or less jobs, right? And I think that misses the point. Because if you talk to those of us who believe in free trade, for example, you had both presidential candidates against free trade. We can show the economics and how it created more jobs and how it's beneficial to the U.S. economy. But if you're unemployed because of trade, that doesn't matter to you. And so what we're trying to work on and what people I'm talking to is to say, let's get over this argument, will more jobs be created or less jobs? But what are we going to do about the people who I call the unemployable worker, the person who really wants to work but can't find a job? Because that's where we're going to have the real social and economic chaos that could potentially be developed, because those people are unemployed, they're not happy, and you can see what happens when you have strife like that.
Well, yeah. And in fact, you already see it. It's already beginning. And I guess what's interesting and what I'm curious about is your vision of how these problems get solved, because a lot of the answers, like for instance, the free trade issue, wasn't free trade. Free trade wasn't the problem. I don't even think either candidate thought free trade was the problem. But it was political suicide not to say certain things, because you have this sort of rabid population who is misinformed and angry and feels disenfranchised. So government is in many ways hamstrung by a populace who doesn't necessarily understand how all the levers work, right? And
yes, absolutely.
And so then is it who... work will change because work and industry and business will be ahead of whatever legal structure we develop, just because it'll take time to catch up, slower moving. I think who will shape this future? Who will help? Will it be a corporate thing? Will corporations step into the breach and say, this is what's going on? Is there a sort of a moral imperative to employ or retrain people? That doesn't seem to be happening right now. Why would it happen, later?
Well, the first part of your question is, what's the role of the business community? And I've been working a lot with the U.S. Chamber Foundation, its 501c3 arm, to really begin looking and delving into the subject and what role does the business community have in this new social contract between employers and employees, or in some cases, independent contractors? And that's a whole other discussion that we could have.
Yes.
But what is that social contract? What does it mean when you no longer get your benefits or your pensions from the corporation because you're an independent contractor and you drive for Uber or your Airbnb or Lyft or whatever it happens to be, the peer-to-peer economy? There's some huge benefits from that, but there's also some social costs and changes. And how do we deal with that? Do we create an Uber rich versus the Uber driver, where the Uber drivers are, the folks who trying to make ends meet, and those who control the app, so to speak, the network effect, are at the top of the food chain? And what does that, what type of animosity does that create? Does it, get people upset? And so part of this discussion has to be within the business community. We can't go to government and ask for them to step up and solve this problem. We as a community, we with the workers and the employers, the unions, the think tanks and others, and when I'm working with the U.S. Chamber Foundation, is to bring folks together to have that conversation. Everyone has a view, but we all need to work together to find a common solution, if there is one. And if we don't, we will unfortunately, see the negative consequences.
Right. I would say in many ways, then you're going to get regulation that maybe you don't want, that won't be maybe helpful, but maybe politically expedient.
That is my fear. You've nailed it right on the head. You know, right now we're in a relatively calm, you know, the grasshopper and the ant, right? You know,
right.
It's summer and spring, jobs, growth, you know, we're hearing
but
good
winter
things.
Is coming.
But winter is coming, right? Oh my gosh, we have to at least say that once in this conversation. but it's the question is, are you prepared for it? You know, have we laid the appropriate foundation in this relatively calm period? Make sure we do this right. You know, it's interesting. And, you know, the United States has always adapted to new technologies and jobs were lost during the Industrial Revolution, but the overall standard of living for most Americans has greatly improved because of technology.
Right, exactly, right.
But you know, here's the thing though, the difference between today's technological impact and the Industrial Revolution was the Industrial Revolution was about taking one job away from a highly skilled worker and replacing it with many low-skilled jobs. You had folks coming from Europe, from the South, the immigration and migration of low-skilled workers and uneducated workforce, you know, coming to fill these low-skilled jobs. The AI revolution is very different. It has taken away the many unskilled and maybe semi-skilled and maybe even skilled jobs, as you said, about doctors and lawyers, and replacing it with one highly skilled, highly educated job in AI and robotics. And that's going to cause a fundamental change in how we look at these things. And the last point I'll make on this about the Industrial Revolution, I get to use my Holy Cross history education on this. You know, the fact is that the Industrial Revolution, as great as it was, also created massive worker strife and world instability. You know,
right.
You had fascism, you had World War II, you had the Cold War, you had labor unions fighting with corporations and the steel mills and the factories. You had the growth of fascism in Western Europe, communism in Asia and Eastern Europe after World War I and through World War II, and a wealth gap that was created. And so this was not, you know, the Industrial Revolution was not a smooth, you know, revolution. It was pretty bloody and chaotic.
Right.
And
right.
We didn't know who was going to win or lose that fight.
Right. And in fact, yeah, so much of our social safety net is as a result of a lot of that strife. So many
Absolutely.
Of our regulations, and it's interesting taking Airbnb maybe for an example, you know, all the hotel regulations to keep people safe, right? So they don't burn alive and something doesn't go wrong. And then you have a disruption, which is like, well, we're going to do this and it's going to be outside the regulations, or Uber outside the regulations. And there was an intent behind the regulation. And it's fair to say, is the regulation outdated? Should it be scrapped? But should everybody be playing with the unregulated playing field? You know, is there a reason? Should we do that? Certainly as a small business, and you mentioned the 1099 workers, and we talk about the gig economy. And as a small business, I got to tell you, it makes me furious because the federal government sets it up so that, yeah, you as an individual can say you're a sole proprietor, but if I hire you as a sole proprietor, they're going to come after me. And if I tell them when to show up because I need to plan my day, they're an employee. And
yes.
They're going to want me to pay taxes, and they're going to want me to pay workers' comp. And they're going to, so it's fiction. It's fiction that, you know, there's just this lack of consistency. And it's only, as far as I'm concerned, it's only gotten more so. I mean, when I started the business, I ended up having to pay workers' comp on people. And now it's not just workers' comp, it's health, it's this, that, and the other thing. And so I don't want to work with any of these gig economy people. And, you know, the big networks use something called permalancers, and they create whole payroll companies to have these people as permalancers. And then they, after they've worked a certain amount of time, they have to let them go for blocks of time. And it's a complete workaround, and it's ridiculous.
Well, what's interesting, getting back to the, you know, here's a question that a lot of people don't know. There's one sector of the economy that the unions absolutely love independent contractors. And do you know what sector that is?
No.
The movie industry. Everybody who works on a movie is an independent contractor. If you look at, you know, the end of, you know, the movie and you're watching the, you know, the names, none of those people work for 21st Century Fox, or if they do, they subcontracted out maybe one of our, you know, technology divisions or something like that. I mean, Fox is the investor, but the producer, the director, the actors, the script, you know, the people who do the lights, they're all independent contractors. The truck drivers are all Teamsters.
And they're all insulated. They're insulated because each production is its own corporation.
But even those corporations aren't, those people are independent contractors. who how work did
they,
on those productions.
How do they get away with that, though? How come I get audited if I hire, you know, New York State's like, need to get some revenue. Let's go look at your books. I say, look. The voiceover talent, this guy plays C-3PO. He's not my employee. You know, he has a website, but I have to go through proving it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure our guys have to go through that as well. But the fact is the unions like it because the way the structure of the movie industry is they're all unionized, unlike certain other industries that are much larger than the movie industry and the tech side. They're not. They have healthcare benefits. They have pension benefits. They have ability to negotiate. I mean, we've all been through, you know, the writer strikes or the screen actor strikes and the IATSE strikes and they have collective bargaining. And yet they are not the employees of the studios.
Well, you know, what's interesting though is within the filmmaking industry, the people who aren't unionized, the animators, the special effects folks, they get raked over the coals a certain amount. And they're, you know, I mean, it's interesting. So are unions, given the way work is headed, are unions going to become more important or less important?
I think that's one of those fundamental questions that have to be asked. And I think sometimes the scary part, so let's look at the Teamsters and the whole issue of autonomous vehicles. You know, if I'm the Teamsters, what scares me the most is not just my membership shrinking to nothing, but I have a tremendous amount of pension and healthcare liability that I've negotiated that I'm responsible for as the union. And where is that money going to come? And if they fold and they don't have the resources, that's going to fall on the taxpayer, you know, the Pension Guarantee Corporation and others. And so, you know, you're finding yourselves with automation in some of these industries where you can see what happened to General Motors. They just had to sell, you know, DirecTV and everything to us and others to make sure that they could pay for their pensions and healthcare benefits.
Right. Well, it's interesting also, I mean, you sort of have unions with almost an iron law of oligarchy where they're more interested in perpetuating the union rather than what serves their membership. I remember back in 92 in England, Arthur Scargill marched on Trafalgar Square for the coal miners, big strike. Previously, under the Thatcher administration, they'd done the same thing, brought the government to its knees, and they won. At that point, Margaret Thatcher was like, you know what? We're not going to build any more coal power stations. I'm not doing this again. So when it happened again to John Major, it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you really have, you know, it takes a long time to build a power station. The writing was very much on the wall. And yet they, you know, the retraining, the what are you doing? How are you shifting? How are you adjusting for where things are going?
And that's why we need to get away from this animosity between labor and business, because we all are in this together. We're all workers, right? At the end of the day, even, you know, the biggest, you know, even if you own a corporation, you're responsible for your board of directors, right? I mean, everyone's a worker. And we need to try to figure out a way to come together to solve some of these critical issues. And that's part of what I'm trying to do with the U.S. Chamber Foundation is try to gather folks in a way that says, okay, we see these clouds forming, you know, and it could go really good or it could go really bad. But if we don't work together, we know the chances of it going bad are far greater. And so let's start doing this now. Let's have this conversation when it's still relatively calm. If we wait until the chaos begins and social unrest, and people getting on Facebook and Twitter organizing protests against, you know, the capitalistic system and businesses and automation, we've lost at that point. And so let's get together now and figure this out in a way that makes sense. We're not going to always agree on stuff, but if we don't start talking and sitting down and understanding each side, it's not going to end well for us.
Well, given that a number of questions... first question is, how receptive is business to listening to this conversation right now?
I think it's a little mixed. I think some businesses understand it, but again, they're so worried about the next quarter, the next year, that getting them to focus on this is rather difficult. But you do have some leading voices out there, you know, that are beginning to talk about the impact of automation, artificial intelligence, and people like Elon Musk and others, at least least they're raising awareness of the issue. But really the conversations that are happening are around the dinner table with friends and family. When you talk to folks about this issue and you have these conversations, they're nervous, they're scared. And that's what makes me want to work even harder on this, because what you don't understand, you fear, and what you fear, you try to kill. And we shouldn't be trying to kill automation, but we should embrace it. But we have to have a better understanding of what is the impact going to be, as I said, around the dinner table and making people feel comfortable.
Do you really feel, though, that people understand it's automation? I almost feel that people are feeling uncomfortable. People are feeling scared, but they don't really understand why. And so what we're seeing actually is scapegoating. You're scapegoating foreigners. You're scapegoating anybody who doesn't look like me, because it must be somebody's fault. I mean, the industrial revolution has failed me. So I'm going to become extreme. I'm going to become extreme politically. I'm going to become extreme socially. I'm going to become extreme gluttony. I'm going to eat everything and fill that void inside me. It almost is like at least with trying to talk to business leaders, you have a smaller set of people to try to wrangle, and even with unions, you could talk to the leadership of the unions, but most of the workforce isn't covered by unions, right?
Right. That's correct. So, but they're going to have to play a key role in this conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, and obviously there are going to be jobs perhaps that nobody knows that might come as a result of this, but what kind of job? I guess, oh my goodness, we're already running towards the end of our time, but the big takeaway is, if I am in business today, do I need to be thinking about this, or is this really my CEO's issue? And then if it's my CEO's issue, what should he be doing?
I think everybody needs to be thinking about this and how we're preparing for, as you said, winter is coming. I think there's some really smart CEOs who are thinking about this already. AT&T, you mentioned companies aren't retraining. AT&T has a great training program, in-house training program, because my understanding is that the CEO's brother works on the line, installing wires. And he said, I want to make sure that my brother is ready for the future. And they've instituted a really interesting in-house job training mechanism. But you often look at it as a whole. So you have to look at if there are training opportunities that exist, government-funded programs like Job Corps, or those corporate in-house training initiatives, the community and four-year college and for-profit colleges. Are they truly meeting the challenges of the future workforce, or are they selling false promises? We have to start looking at what this means. One of the interesting points that I took away from an event that CTA had, it was they had the head of the Virginia Community Colleges speaking, and he asked the audience, and these are the people who put on the Consumer Electronics Show. They asked him, they asked the audience, what's the number one job in Virginia that we have a shortage, that we have a shortage of workers? And of course, everyone's hands, coders, analytics, all this stuff. He said, no, the number one job we have a shortage is electricians.
Right.
We don't have enough electricians.
Right.
And I think we also have to start getting away from this idea of everyone should be a doctor or a lawyer or a coder and have these skills. I talk to my friends who do construction or who do air conditioning, and they're desperate for people.
Yes. And it's interesting how much, at school and how we evaluate high schools, their success, how many people are going to college, how many are college ready. And I almost think, should everybody go to college? I mean, could be a wonderful learning experience. Great. But in terms of if we're thinking of college as preparing you for the workforce, there are all sorts of necessary trades which can't be outsourced because they have to be done on the spot.
That is correct.
And certainly the devaluing of those trades needs to change, I think.
I agree 110% that my wife's relatives are plumbers and electricians, and they do very well.
Well, I know. It's like, my landscaper with the Lexus.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But there is, my son just graduated from Clemson, and, I definitely fell into this, you need to go to college for 4 years, and I get it. But, when you see our relatives who took a career path of the trades and they're doing really well and they're happy, is sort of let the child decide, you know, the direction that they want as they're migrating through, and maybe we shouldn't put such an emphasis. But the problem with that is if I say that and my son went to college, you know, now am I an elitist? Like, oh, well, it's right. Okay for my kid to go to college, but not yours, and your kid should go into trades. And I think that's something that we have to try to figure out.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, that was one of the things for me and looking at my children. I have two boys and, you know, I think I need to reevaluate what is success? You know, what is happiness? What do I want them to lead good lives. What will get them a good life? You know?
And that's a new social contract that we have to start having that conversation on.
Right.
And, you know, what is the goal at the end of the day? And it's a tough one. It's philosophical. It's social. It's economic. And they're right. All tied together.
Right.
Political, of course.
Yeah. Sneak that in there. Bon chance to all of us. Well, thank you so much. We've reached the end of the official interview here, and I have enjoyed our conversation tremendously.
Well, I have too. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Rick Lane. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.